have braved the torrential downpour. It's lovely to see you. We're now moving into the panel discussion Q&A workshop section of the symposium. And I'm delighted to say we've got a fantastic panel of people here to really address the question that lies behind the overarching vision of the education strategy, which is that LSE lead in the provision of a research-informed social science education. So the effort here is to attempt to unpack that a little bit, have people on the panel say what they understand by that and or how it operates in their discipline or department. And then to open up to question and answer, and then we'll move on to some breakout workshops, which Neil will coordinate. So I'm going to basically let the panel start now, but I'll just introduce you very quickly. Peter Ramsey here is from the Law Department and chairs their teaching committee. He's going to chair the panel. John Foster is the Students' Union Education Officer for this year. Susanna Morato is from the Geography and Environment Department. Jessica Templeton, LSE 100. Tarek Bakawi, International Relations, and Claire Gordon from the Teaching and Learning Centre.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Did I miss somebody out?
No.
No. Okay, good. So, if we can fire away, that would be great. The idea is to finish this session around about 11:45. So, over to you, Peter.
Thank you, Jane. We only have a very brief time each, so I'm going to keep everybody to time, if that's all right, including myself. I'm going to put my timer on. In the Law Department, we thought when we were writing the education strategy that we should make our strengths in research somehow a selling proposition for our education, and to try and for ourselves and also for other stakeholders, including the students, obviously, to make ourselves more conscious of how our research strengths are a positive for our education offer and not something that's intention with them, which is, I think, often how the world seems to understand these things. So that was the thought, that we would make our strengths in research central to our education and a positive in it. Thinking about that, then there are different. So that brings us to our question for the morning: what is a research-informed education? Here's a slide which I've borrowed from Claire, which is just gives you a sort of matrix, a way of constructing different conceptions of a research-informed education. Here we're in the area. These two are in the area of students as researchers. So we can think of a research-informed education as students as the researchers. In this construction, it's divided into two different groups, teaching students research methods, essentially, and their students actually doing the research there. So we can think of a research-informed education as students as researchers. We can think of it as research-led education, where academics or researchers, the way I understand this, take students through their own research or questions that arise from live research. And then third, this research tutored, which I just want to come back to, which seems to me to be in many ways the most important one. I'm not sure I like the phrase research tutored, nor do I like the way it's described here, because it seems to me what we're really talking about is researcher-led education or academic-led education or indeed research-informed education. Which is to say, when people like us, academics, take students through the literature, raise the questions that the literature raises with them and ask them to respond to that, to engage them in a discussion about that literature. And there, I understand, and I think I speak for the majority of my colleagues, because we've adopted this approach in the education strategy, what we understand by that is that we are engaging them in the process and inculcating in them the habits of mind of scholarly and academic researchers, the critical approach that we would take to the disciplinary practice. So we introduce them to the way lawyers think, this is the Law Department, and then to the way the critical thoughts that people who think about law and what lawyers do have thought as well. and the questions that raises, and we take them through that. And we ask them to respond orally and in writing to those questions. Now, that's really quite a classical thought about what research-informed education is. The reason I want to emphasize, while we are looking energetically at doing more of these things that we already do, and I think that that's an important component of what we should be doing, nevertheless, it's critical that we start to get this, understand this bit better, because it's going to remain central to what we do, it seems to me, especially in undergraduate education, but in all taught programs. We need to articulate much more clearly to ourselves and to the world what the why we do that, what the benefits of it are, why students should want us to do that, why it has the difficulties in it that are in it, and why it should be delivered by academic researchers. In other words, why they should pay for a higher education and what that higher bit means. And it means that they're going to be asked the difficult questions by people whose professional practice is to ask those difficult questions of the disciplinary material, academics. And I think if we need to articulate that urgently, we need to understand ourselves what it is that we're doing, but also to get across to the policy world and to our students that they should want us to do this. That's an education that's worth having, because it's an education in intellectual independence. It's an education in drawing them towards being the sort of people who can handle themselves, who can stand on their own two feet in legal discourse or social scientific discourse more generally. That they can rely on their own judgment. At the end, if they come out of this place with the first, they can rely on their own judgment, have confidence in their own judgment when reading these kind of social scientific and legal materials. And while these things I think are important, there we go, that's my time up, I think there remains the emphasis in understanding what we're doing. So that's my two pennies worth. Next, we're going to ask Jessica.
I think this is a great question, and it's something that we spend a lot of time thinking about in the context of LSE 100, which I won't spend any time explaining that. I'll assume you all know what this course is. But basically, if the aim of a research-informed education is to develop students' abilities to think critically about any issue that they encounter, they have to be independent thinkers. They have to engage in some form of self-directed learning. So the research must come in the way that academics sort of model this process for students, and they share their ideas. They say, okay, this is what I'm excited about. These are the questions I've asked. This is the way I've chosen to investigate this issue with the evidence and the methods and all of this. And then I think we have to hand over to the students and say, now, what do you think? What do you find compelling? What do you find interesting? And how are you going to take this forward? So it's not just about us kind of sharing our research and then expecting students to kind of learn from what we're telling them, but to actually give them the tools to kind of run with it and to be imaginative and creative in their own learning, and to give them some sense of ownership through this. So in LSE 100, one of the ways that we've tried to do this is to bring in more group work, group research projects and things. And there's a limit to what we can do in a course that has 1,600 students and that's highly structured. But we have tried to give them more options. So within each project, we say, okay, here are some different things you might want to explore. You decide as a group what you want to do. Go explore and come back and give us a presentation, and you're going to teach your peers about what you've learned and why you found this so exciting. And in that process, we have seen students get much more excited. The work that they do is much better quality than what they were doing before, when we were much more structured with what they were doing, when they weren't able to take ownership. And they spend far more time on this work than they ever used to. And it's interesting, and they get each other excited, and they start to learn, I think, not only about what they know, but they start to see what other people know, and they learn to collaborate with each other and to build on that very effectively. And so for us, this is something we're working on. It's not something we've kind of reached the peak on. We're still developing our approach to this. But for me, I think this is the cornerstone of a research-informed education, is getting the students involved in the production of knowledge.
Thank you, Jessica.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So I sit at the intersection of historical and theoretic work at International Relations, and I just want to talk from my sort of personal experience and practices. A lot of what the first two speakers have said are ways in which you teach the student to have a research-minded mentality, to be a critical thinker, to someone who can go and write up a research project. I want to talk a little bit more about what's involved in drawing the students into the research that faculty might be doing. And I think that broadly there are sort of three ways that this is done. I think the first and most common way, and also the most superficial, is the idea that students be taught the latest findings or research. Right? So if you come out of a tradition of social science in which research is cumulative and always progressive, what's been done in the old times doesn't matter. You only want the most recent stuff. So that's kind of one sort of model, and I think in some ways the most kind of common model of what an LSE academic would think if you said research-led teaching. So that's one. It's the one I don't like. The second one is, when you come to do a new project, you might my next project will be on the Korean War. So I might create a course that was about the Korean War from start to finish, right? So that as I become familiar with that historical period and topic, I'm teaching a course to students about how the war went, the larger world politics of it, theoretical approaches to it, etc. So it's the substantive topic that the academic is working on, and you teach a kind of basic course in that area, and that obviously could be done at undergraduate or MSc level. And then the third and final way, and it's the way that is in my own practice, is when you invite the students to participate in a research problematic that you're working on. So say, for example, I'm going to work on the idea of the state. I might find, 15 books, some seminal articles, some of which are very old, some of which are new, some of which, in between, and simply read through them with the students, right? What you were saying about introducing them to a literature is in a way the kind of thing that I mean. And what I do in my MSc course and in a sort of truncated version for my third year BSc course is essentially do that. They read a book a week, the master's students half a book a week, the undergraduates, and we discuss that in depth as a kind of problematic, say, around empire and war. That is generally the way that where I fit my projects. And each year, I change up about two-thirds of those books, right? It's what I want to read, some core texts that stay there, and then the things that I'm thinking, the things that have come out, the things that I found in the meantime, I add in. So that course stays fresh, and I'm able to use it as part of my own thinking. So that's the practice I like, that third way. Now, let me just note two last things in closing. One, the kind of classic place for that kind of research teaching in the U.S. Academy is PhD coursework, where professors can decide, basically in August, I think we're going to read all of Foucault this year. We need to read the, 13 College de France lectures. So that's what we're going to assign the PhD students. I'm going to get my faculty friends in, and we're just going to read every other week one of these books and have a discussion. Now, what I'd note about that is the flexibility, which is in part denied us by the relatively robust course approval and time-consuming course approval process in LSE, and the absence of PhD coursework where you might work at that level. So I usually try to get the PhD-bound MSCs to take my course through various processes of selection, people who would be up for reading monographs in the way that I've described.
Great. Thanks, Tara. Suzanne.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about what we do in geography and environment, and it's difficult to put it in 5 minutes because we have a very wide spectrum of activities, teaching activities that are research-led in our department, and I'll give you examples across the spectrum. So at the very basic end, we use examples and case studies from our own research to motivate students and inspire them, which is particularly useful when you're teaching basic things like microeconomics and econometrics. And how can we make this alive for the students by using examples from our case studies? So, for example, I've done some work in policy pricing in Machu Picchu, and I use that to as an example of pricing. Did some work on the Olympic Games, valuing the intangible benefits of the Olympics to London. I use that as an example for public goods. And the students really like it because they can see how these basic concepts can be applied to policy and in practice, and it makes it come alive for them. So going a bit further, in other courses, we might want to structure a whole lecture, not the whole course if we're teaching basic microeconomics, but maybe a whole lecture on recent developments. So for students to see that the discipline is evolving and we are at the forefront of that discipline. And so, for example, 7 years ago, I started teaching behavioral economics and the environment in a standard environmental economics course. And today, behavioral economics is mainstream, so I don't do that anymore. Now I've incorporated it in the normal course, and now we do green finance as a recent development. And the recent development lecture always changes from year to year, so the students know that we are on top of the material, and also has the side benefit of the students knowing what we do. We recently ran some focus groups in our department, and one of the things that the students said is they like to know what we do, they like to know the faculty, and using examples and specific lectures within even standard basic courses to do that is a nice way to get them, to introduce them to what we do. Then the next step in this continuum is to basically have whole courses or whole programs, as you just said, surrounding these new developments. It could be something on behavioral science, it could be something on spatial econometrics, on GIS. So we also do that, specific courses that follow recent developments. And then at the other end of the spectrum, the more exciting bit is having students as producers of research. And we do that in two ways. Sometimes we are able to incorporate specific group projects, like in LSE 100, where students formulate a research question, get together as a group, collect the data, quantitative or qualitative, analyze the data using different types of techniques, and then they might present the data in a written form or in an oral form. And that can be done as a summative work or formative work. It doesn't work so well as formative work because it's a lot of work and they feel it's not really rewarded, so we've experimented with that. It works better as summative work. However, having said that, some of my colleagues are experimenting with really exciting new ways of doing some formative work and involving students in their research. My colleague Nancy Holman has a Students as Producers project where she got some money from the LTI to buy some cameras, and she gets her planning students to go around and film planning processes in London, and then it's formative work, but at the end of the year there's a film event with best prizes for cinematography, for judges' choices and so on, and really gets the students involved in this particular group activity. So that's so a new way of sort of involving students in these kinds of group work. And at the final end, we have student dissertations. We firmly believe that this is a nice way to engage students in research and in liaising with staff on a one-to-one basis by having students doing dissertations. In our department, not all undergraduates do dissertations, and one of the things that Richard and I are very keen to implement is more students doing dissertations. And for that, we're trying to simplify research methods, having half units of research methods to try to get more students involved. Chris Mims, the deputy head for economic history, told me that one of the reasons that they have 100% satisfaction rate in their NSS survey is that all their students do a dissertation. So we would like to aim for that as well. And I'll just finalize with one point. I don't think, and maybe you disagree with me here, I don't think you need to be a five-star researcher to lead successful research-led teaching. In our department, we're very keen to have teaching-only faculty that have the time to invest in spending time with the students to produce their own research, taking students on field trips, field work, and so on. We feel that a lot of staff don't have the time to do that, and a teaching-only staff could do that. But, of course, they need to be people who are aware of the latest developments in research, that go to conferences like we do, that are able to understand that research and transmit it to students.
Okay. Thank you, Susanna. We're doing so well. We're almost back on time, despite having started late. So, Claire, then. You've still only got 5 minutes.
That's right. Yeah, half of what I want to say. So perfect. Basically, we've been asked to think about what we mean by a research-informed social science education at the LSE. And I wanted to start off with a quote from Mary McAleese, who was the chair of a high-level group on the modernisation of higher education done by the European Commission. And I think what this points to me is thinking about what really is the nature of the higher in higher education, and surely what it comes down to is that relationship between research and education. And I think this sort of, we have already been told now that we're aspiring towards leading in social science research informed education, but I think we really, as we're doing today, need to continue that discussion at our disciplinary levels, thinking about who our students are, and thinking about both the content and processes that we get our students to engage in as part of their education. And so I think that the structural divides that have existed for quite a long time now as a result of the REF we need to be working against to bridge those structural and operational divides to see how we can bring research and education close together. And I don't think it's easy. Disciplines have different epistemologies. What we needed to get our students to do is different across the disciplines, what levels they're at. But this framework that Peter has already laid out in very eloquently, I think, is something which has gained quite a lot of currency in the educational research literature in the last 10 years. And of course you can critique it, and there are other frameworks out there. But I think it provides a very useful structure if we're trying to look across the programmes in our departments, think beyond just what do we do as individuals, but what we do at the programme level for both our undergraduates and postgraduates, and think about maybe these could be thought about in terms of perhaps cogs, interlocking cogs. So obviously, research-based education is one end of the spectrum. We're getting our students to engage in inquiry-based learning, and I'm going to talk for 2 minutes about a project that I've been involved in for the last 6 years. But obviously, learning about the methods of research down here, where am I? I lost it. Learning about the methods of research down here will enable you to participate in research education, research-based education. So what I want to say about in the last 2 minutes is a programme of research-based education that the Teaching and Learning Centre have been running for the last 5 or 6 years. And what it involves is putting students from across the school, cross-disciplinary, multi-year groups of students who are given a broad theme such as sustainability, social change. This year the students are going to be looking at poverty and inequality in line with the anniversary of the Booth Maps. And they, in 2 weeks, manage to come up with a research question, conduct a literature review, identify a methodology that's going to work, collect data, analyse it, and present it in a written conference. Their research papers on the website for the sceptics among you who doubt the capacity of first-year undergraduates to undertake research. And it really is a sort of transformative educational experience for the students. To give you an example of the flavour of the sorts of things that they looked at, last year we had students asking about how does the neoliberalisation of UK universities affect academics, research and well-being. We teamed up with Imperial. We had students looking at online dating apps to see how that had affected attitudes to monogamy and consent and non-monogamy. Students are put in the driver's seat and then they produce incredible work. And I think, just to sort of give you a flavour of their feedback, I think this is really, really important in thinking about, and maybe we'll hear more from some of the students who are here today, although I don't know how many are left right now, in terms of how they experience their education at the LSE. I think this quote, and maybe I'll end on that, sums it all up. Our ideas became the focus of our investigation in LSE groups, whereas they are only secondary in LSE undergraduate courses. The supervisors guide you, but you do the thinking for yourself rather than being told what to do. And I think that sort of, how are we going to make our students critically informed, critically thinking, research-informed social scientists? Well, I would argue that we need to be getting our students to be doing research and as far as possible from the start of their undergraduate career, while recognising, obviously, that a year one student can't do the same thing as somebody who's been in the business for 35 years. That doesn't mean to say we can't, with our colleagues, in our teams, in our departments, in the context of our disciplines or multi-disciplines, interrogate this question.
Thank you. Claire, John.
Thank you. I think it's an incredibly important and interesting question, and I think a lot of the time when we talk about that question, what is leading research-informed education, the focus is usually on teaching. What makes research-informed teaching? How do we incorporate research into our teaching? Which is incredibly, incredibly important. One thing I do want to talk about slightly, I think, sometimes gets overlooked, is learning. Education is about teaching and learning, so what does research-informed learning look like? And I do think when you look at it in that way, the question takes on a slightly different context. LSE students are exceptional, and I'm not saying that just because I was one. But they are an incredibly diverse mix of intelligent and compassionate people from all around the world. But each and every student here at the LSE has had a very different educational experience up until the point they arrive. They're used to different education systems, they're used to being assessed in different ways, they're used to being supported in different ways. So when we talk about research-informed education, that should absolutely be in reference to cutting-edge academic contents. But for the LSE to be world-leading in this area, that must also include the latest research in education theory to guide the way students learn. The institution has to do everything it can to support students and ensure they're able to reach the maximum potential in their ability to learn. And I think that is about what happens in the classroom, but that's also about how students learn outside the classroom. That's also about the facilities we provide and the support systems we have in place and how we create an environment that maximises their potential to learn during their time here. There are some wonderfully innovative teachers at LSE, many of whom will be at tonight's Teaching Awards, and there's my little plug for that, so please do one. And the best teaching I experienced when I was here was not just when research informed the content, but when research informed how I was assessed and how I was fed back to, and how I was supported all the way through that process. How I was engaged not just in terms of substance, but also in terms of style, I suppose, for want of a better word. And I think it's vital that pedagogical research informs the format of the learning analysis. And I think that means we do need to look at moving away from the idea of sticking to the norm just for the sake of sticking to the norm, moving away from the idea that we do closed book exams and we do the lecture class format just because that's the way we've always done it, or because that's the way that is the norm within the discipline. And I think that is what the school is starting to do this year with the education strategy. I think that's a fantastic first step. LSE Life and the upcoming Education Covenant are starting to move the school in that direction. But I think it needs to be kept at the forefront of thinking for the school and departments as they get strategies become action plans and timelines and ultimately progress. As a history student, I'm just, I suppose, a bit of a general geek. I'm incredibly interested in the history of the school as an institution. And it has always been a leading institution. In the sense that where it goes, sooner or later, other places seem to follow. And I think the more I seem to think about it, there's one small nuance that I think the web set out overlooks, and I apologise if I have used this line a couple of times before. To know the causes of things is fantastic, but to understand the causes of things is much more important. That is what an LSE education needs to equip and support students to do. And that can only be done if research informs not just what is taught, but the way it is taught and the way our students learn it.
Thank you. There's a variety of views. If anyone's got any strong disagreements or questions, they'd be very welcome.
It's kind of a comment that follows on from John's point, and that's the question about assessment. Because it's all very well saying, do these things. But students, in my experience, both at undergraduate and MSc level, are very reluctant to let go of the side of the board and to swim for themselves. And I'm going to use and steal the idea of the intellectual independence. And we spend a lot of time saying, as an MSc student, you're not going to create brand new knowledge. It's your selection of materials, your understanding and representation that's there. So it's a real challenge for how we actually assess and how we explain how we're going to assess that research-based learning kind of experience, and how you deal with those people who want to jump out and do the LSE groups, and how you deal with those who just want to follow an essay that got a great score last year. And that's a real problem, because the ones that are going to succeed, particularly on that intellectual independence, are non-standard. And explaining to students that the best ones are not the ones that you want to look at if you are being cautious is a real challenge.
Anyone want to come back straight away, Suzanne?
I agree with that. With my experience of running student-led projects, student doing group work, analysing their data, presenting, some loved it and some really hated it because they thought it was a lot of work, they didn't get on with the others, why am I doing this, why can't I just do an exam, it'd be much easier for me. So it is an issue. We in the end abandoned the project because of it was a minority of students, but they were very vocally against it. And I think if it's a summative work, then they understand how it's useful for them. It's just for knowledge and developing their intellectual curiosity. It's not to everyone's taste, and it does remain a difficulty to find something that is good for everyone. And that's why we feel we need more time and people specialised in the pedagogy of teaching on how to do this properly, that sometimes we're maybe not able to do, and bringing people in that are specialists in teaching might help us reach all these students and create environments that are good for everyone.
Claire?
Yeah, I mean, just to back up what Suzanne was saying, I think that what you're talking about is the whole process of how you design assessments, and it's not just designing what you're going to do at the end of the course, it's about designing the whole of the learning so that what you're doing and how you're explaining what's expected of the students they're prepared for right from the start. And I think that what sometimes students do find dissertation stressful in the third year, particularly if the first and second year all they've done are exams, but if we can start to, and I'm not saying this is going to happen overnight, but if we can start by trying to diversify what we're getting our students to do from the moment they enter university, and structure the assessment so the students aren't just pushed towards this strategic, oh, well, I know I'm good at exams, so I can get a first, so that's what I'm going to, that's my comfort zone. But we design our courses and our assessment so that the students can build those other skills and see it as valuable to do so. I think that's the journey we're on. But it takes time, resources, investment, and reward. Proper reward, not, I think, just maybe controversially, I think teaching awards are fantastic, but people need to be rewarded properly within their career structure.
Just to draw our attention to a contradiction that is emerging here underneath this, in the kind of idea of, students do their own research projects, they do a dissertation and so on. Our problem is that in our MSc, we have a large MSc, they all do a dissertation. There's no way 27 of us can supervise adequately all of those projects. We wouldn't be doing anything else but doing that. And then the answer over here to that kind of problem is more specialized teaching staff. But from where I stand, it's exactly the first class. I've never made a decision between research and teaching until I came to the UK, so I never have done that. It's exactly the first class academics who are able to engage in a supervision role with MSCs and with undergraduates and get them really thinking about stuff. But if we're going to have enough people to do that, then some kind of teaching-only track is the kind of suggestion that's being made. I think we want to be aware of that.
I'll just say that teaching-only track doesn't mean that the person never does a piece of research ever again in their life. I just want to make that clear.
It does, and I would be all for building it. I can see lots of reasons for it, and their disciplines are different. But in the real world, you're telling me that you don't make distinctions between someone who's on a teaching track and someone who's on a research track. I mean, elite universities go for the people who are on research track. And many PhDs, if they could, would choose a research track, but are so desperate for a job, they'll take anything coming and can find themselves locked in a teaching track, which in some ways may be good for this from the school's point of view, because you get a first-class PhD person doing teaching for you, not so good for the researcher.
But you can get someone who was a brilliant academic but now doesn't want to do research
there
anymore,
we go.
For example, and
yeah.
That could be an extremely inspiring. Some of our emeritus professors are incredibly inspiring to the students, and they've had their career.
Yeah, we do that too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's one way where you can get a top... someone who used to be a top researcher but now is on a teaching position.
I shall restrain myself. Although I completely agree with you. I think that's the kind of person that is an ideal thought, but that's not a career track. That's an end of career option, which is a good idea. I completely agree. On that, though, just one thing. You slightly suggested, I agree with you, that people who are keen on the intellectual independence thing will thrive in those kind of projects. But I would resist the implication that churning out the essays and turning up at the exam isn't a route towards intellectual independence. Mm-hmm. I agree it's also a route to rather dull education. But at Oxford and Cambridge, it's turned out for centuries, many very independent, intellectually minded people. So I would resist that distinction. So that would be my only point. So is there a question here, though, about choice and compulsory? Because we debated this. We have the sense that our assessment is a bit dull. We are very exam-based. And it's not, John, I think, because we want to keep doing that because it's the norm. We think there are good reasons for our reliance on closed book exams, the reasons of equality, level playing field, of not spending our time in plagiarism. That's a resource question. It's important. Various other reasons about group work. But we are very conscious that it's a bit flat. It's a bit uninspiring. Are we at the stage, and it'd be interesting to know what people's experiences are, of when we make it compulsory, it's not very popular. The dissertation on the master's course, I think, is done, but it wasn't like the students embraced it wholeheartedly, and our undergraduates certainly wouldn't, I think, embrace it. Very few of them take the option that's available to do a dissertation. So is there any sense we should make that compulsory, or is it just, like you say, Claire, a question of introducing this stuff?
So one distinction is between the dissertation, which is clearly doing some research, and the essay of your own topic of your own choice. which is, sorry, if it's a half unit in the middle of the term, it's going to be a resource constraint. You cannot, we tell students, you cannot go out and do realistic data collection because you just don't have the time. But that clearly is also an independent, so some courses will have, here are five essay topics, choose one and write about it. In this particular case, it's a, here's the broader area of the course, find a topic within that that you are interested in and do the research. So it's not just the searching and dissertations, it potentially is also space for the self-directed essay topic.
Yeah. I do think it's important to go back to the discipline and not just think about how can I mix and match different assessment methods. I think we need to go back to the sort of fundamentals of the discipline and what the skills or knowledge bases or disciplinary attitudes we want our students to develop, and then design the teaching and the assessment around that. I think that's really, really important, and it will be different for everyone in the room.
Okay, I'm in the economics department, and I agree absolutely. You assembled this fantastic panel, and I'm really reluctant to burst the mood because I'd like to come away from it. But I have some reality to insert about how we get to what you've all proposed, each of which was fantastic, I thought, which is that the economics department, which remains a very important pillar, our students sometimes when they're trying to transfer in to BSc economics, and I have 40 applications to transfer in this year to give you an idea of what happens. When this happens, we propose any of these things that were up against the ethos of economics as an international and a discipline that anthropologists can study. And the problem is, so it's not that coming from the department itself is a bunch of people who set themselves up like this. It's that we have achieved our excellence by reflecting this world pressure, chiefly American, but not entirely, because the Americans also have then propagated it. Not the liberal arts college, although some colleagues have come up with that model that I don't like teaching only track either, but the idea of a liberal arts college professor who does some research or follows it. How do we get it there? Because if we don't get it into the economics department, everybody else can do well. All I can think of is maybe I should leave the economics department. Anybody here? I'm really a great departmental tutor. We're up against a really powerful force. The final thing on that is the other really powerful force, which you must all feel because it infects all of you, which is I saw on the first slide that was up while we were having breakfast was the thing about they may not get a neoliberal job, but they will make the world a kinder place. Now, actually, my colleagues would not have, they could have had neoliberal jobs at three times the salary. So their heart is in the right place. But the point is that our students come in, and in fact, they don't even come in all wanting to be investment bankers. It's the 25% do. I understand they're even infecting the history department. I remember somebody who writes for the Washington Post now giving us a course where she said, she was a master's student at LSE in social psychology. She said, and I found myself applying for a job at Goldman Sachs. And you find yourself there, and so how we combat that, we have to be aware of that. And I love your suggestions on that, because it can come from outward in, but instead it's spreading the wrong way from economics, finance, accounting, and finance. And LSE, to save itself, very desperately, and my colleagues agree on that, very desperately need this other input.
So what you mean is it's a rather rigid doctrinal education in economics that has to be stuck to?
The trouble is if you haven't taught certain things, which you know about, then the students are not considered to be well-educated, both at all levels.
Yeah.
Okay. PhDs are getting a little better. Maybe it will trickle down because economics faced a crisis.
But
it needs more evidence.
Yeah, but that
now.
Absorbs
it
all.
Needs more applications.
Yeah, but that absorbs all 3 years of available time in an economic an undergraduate degree.
No,
in economics.
No, it doesn't absorb the third year. But by the third year, we've knocked the stuffing out of it.
Yeah, right.
Any views?
I think you can still bring research into economics. I mean, I'm an economist in the geography department, and I bring a lot of my research, and I've got students from the economics department coming to do the course because it's a bit more applied, and they can see how the concepts that I am so familiar with work in practice. And I can't see some of the things that they gain from doing these projects and dissertations would be useful out there when they go for a job, as that final quote that you showed. They can get a job in consulting because someone would know that they can do that type of work. So I think some of the skills that they learn through this would be useful for them as well, even though they have to have micro and macro and econometrics in their first year. That's fine. I think it's compatible.
Yes. Do the economic students embrace your group with a great relief?
See, I'm the minority of our students. GY222, I tell students, please take it in the second year because it'll enlighten the rest of your economics. But the trouble is that it's great that they take it, but not everybody does.
No, but it coincides with other... I mean, there's lots of clashes. It's almost impossible for them to take it as well.
Yeah, Jessica? Well, that's the other thing. Jessica? Have practical
things. I mean, for me, when I was thinking about this question, one of the challenges we faced in LSE 100 is that we kept kind of approaching this as though we're teaching students to become researchers, but we're not necessarily. We're teaching them to think critically and to go out into the world and to be able to tackle problems in whatever way they choose. And so for me, I mean, we need to teach the process of production of knowledge. We need to teach how we create arguments and what kinds of evidence we use, et cetera, so that they can investigate all of this. But this can happen even without doing more research projects in class. I mean, this is about the way we structure classes and give students some ownership in kind of critiquing evidence and all of this. But there are lots of ways of bringing this into education, whether it's undergraduate or master's, I think, that are not just research projects.
John?
Just one point I just want to do pick up on that is that Jim alluded to is kind of this, I think there is, to an extent, there is a cultural problem, definitely, at LSE. And I think what I would say is that students themselves are not only complicit in that, but kind of drive that forward. And I think it starts in the first year, and you kind of build up this idea of the Goldman Sachs kind of, and that drives then a lot of the way people think about their learning, the way people learn throughout their 3 years here. I've never been in another institution, so I don't know if that is just an LSE problem. I imagine it's probably a problem more and more across higher education, but it does seem to be more prevalent here. I think what that does link to, and I think what LSE needs to start to get better understanding, is that I think there is still a tendency to look at teaching in isolation from everything else that makes up this university, in terms of the support services, in terms of students' mental health and well-being. And I think the school is starting to move towards that, but I think all of these parts need to link together much better. And I think it's only by doing that that we are going to be able to overcome that culture. And I think it's only by acknowledging the intrinsic link between the two that we are going to be able to improve the educational offer at LSE as well.
Okay, thanks. Robert, and then...
I just want to go a bit further from what you said, Peter, about defending the exam system, actually, because I think it's more than just about equality and avoiding plagiarism. I think, actually, there's a normative case to be made in defence of the traditional model. And I think I'm a recent convert to the idea of hard questions in exams. I used to, for a long time, think that easy questions were good because we're good enough to tell how good you are, even if we give you a nice, easy question. But actually, I'm now coming around to the idea that we should set brutal questions because actually, 2-2 students are going to get 2-2 regardless of what we ask them because they're going to write the same thing because they've already prepared. 2-1 students are going to adapt a little bit, they're going to move a little bit, they're going to have some ability to. We can see that. The point I want to make is that the beauty of the exam system is we are good enough, I think we are, to assess how good these people are in a 3-hour exam. People reveal themselves in that environment. Now, what I really like, though, is the LSE 100, because that, I think, is the space in which we can broaden out this kind of the project in research and in that.
Sure.
But I think there is a strong normative on for the SAM system, the 3-hour traditional model, as being an excellent method of truly assessing these people. You reveal yourself in 3 hours, we can tell how good you are, and we will tell you how good you are. And I think it's actually, there's not enough defences made of the traditional system. It's always assumed the new progressive ideas are good just for that reason, and I don't think that follows.
Okay, on that point, you don't want to hand on to Neil.
Sorry, can I just say thank you so much. I mean, pity everybody who's not here. really and hasn't heard this incredibly rich sharing of ideas and information. Thank you very, very much indeed. Really appreciate it.